as busy as we've ever been in terms of the number of volcanoes that are active in the state.
Scientists monitor unusual volcano and earthquake activity in western Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, two brothers and their dad celebrate Rasmus and Grants to pursue art projects.
So we all went up to Anchorage, and that was really fun. Apparently we only go on family vacations if we win awards. So.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
In the past few months, Alaska has seen a flurry of volcanic eruptions and sizable earthquakes. It's disrupted life in the Aleutian Islands and the far western Brooks Range, and it's got scientists wondering how all the activity might be connected. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
Right now, five volcanoes in the Aleutian Islands are on alert. John Power of the Alaska Volcano Observatory says it's the most activity they've seen at once in their 26-year history.
We're as busy as we've ever been in terms of the number of volcanoes that are active in the state.
Only one of those has caused major disruptions so far. Pavlov Volcano sent up an ash plume and prompted days of local flight cancellations earlier this month. But volcanoes seem to be waking up all across the chain. Shishaldin, Cleveland, and Veniaminof in the eastern and central Aleutians have been on alert for months now. In the western Aleutians, the AVO put Semisopochnoi on watch just last week. But does it mean there's something causing all these flare-ups? Power says not necessarily.
At this point, you know, we have to say it's coincidental. It could be that there is a larger process at work, but we're not able to say what that is at this point in time, or if there is such a process. You know, perhaps the answer is we haven't been looking long enough to know.
Scientific understanding of plate tectonics began evolving in Alaska with the 1964 Good Friday quake, and Power says it's still a work in progress. If there is something bigger going on, they can't identify it, at least not yet. That's also true 1,000 miles north of the Aleutians, where another seismic mystery has stretched across 2 months. Outside Noatak in the far western Brooks Range, there's been a series of 5 earthquakes, each with a magnitude 5.7. The latest was on Monday. Mike West of the Alaska Earthquake Center says the Noatak quakes are too far away to impact volcanoes in the Aleutians.
Some of this is just a confluence of what really is day-to-day activity in Alaska.
But West also says their grasp on that activity is, well, shaky. They know the basics. A tectonic plate in the region seems to be slowly pulling away from the continent. Normally, that would cause one large quake. Here, West says it's caused 5 smaller quakes instead.
You can think of this as the Earth sort of inching along instead of doing it in one big movement.
Still, a magnitude 5.7 earthquake is nothing to scoff at. It shows up on seismic monitors around the world, including the 400 stations in Alaska. For Mike West, that's a good thing. Even with 2 new short-term monitors in Noatak and Kotzebue, he doesn't get enough information from the Noatak Area Network alone.
We have never had a focus on western and northern Alaska, and I personally feel that's a bit of a liability for the state. And this sequence certainly indicates that, you know, there's plenty of opportunity in these areas for earthquakes to intersect with populations.
That's his takeaway from this period of heightened activity. Alaskans live on volatile land. Quakes and volcanoes can damage property in the interior and interrupt air travel or set off tsunamis at sea. Even in remote towns, West says more monitors are always a good thing. Back in the Aleutians, the AVO's John Power is getting ready for some new monitoring of his own on active Cleveland volcano located in the uninhabited islands of the Four Mountains. This summer, the AVO will tag along with an archaeological expedition to put seismic monitors on Cleveland for the first time. It's a step forward, but there's still a long way to go. 4 of the AVO's on-alert volcanoes are repeat offenders with a long baseline of data. The 5th is more of an outlier. Semisopochnoi had been quiet since 1987, the year before the AVO was formed, before it rumbled to life with a swarm of little earthquakes last week. Since the island is so remote, Power says they don't know much about it.
It's a volcano with a fairly violent past. It's had a whole number of eruptions. It's actually a large caldera with a whole number of events and some very large lava flows that are geological investigations suggest are not that old. And we are currently watching it very, very closely because the type of earthquake activity that it's experiencing is what you might see or might expect at a reawakening volcano.
Like the scientists near Nowatak, Power says the AVO focuses on what they can address in the short term. They might not fully understand the science of what's happening, but they can do their best to keep tabs on it. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
4 weeks into salmon fishing restrictions, the atmosphere along the Kuskokwim River is tense. At a meeting Tuesday, the stress the closures are causing was obvious, but as KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, gillnet fishing for salmon is near.
The Bethel test fishery numbers are showing many more chum and sockeye salmon in the river than kings. That's one signal that fishing could begin soon. At a Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group meeting Tuesday, subsistence fishermen met with managers to figure out when the gillnet restrictions can be relaxed. Reports of stress along the river in some cases were extreme. Working group member Fritz Charles reported on what he's hearing about possible violence on the river.
They're starting an organization as we speak. And if we keep going on like this, what we're going on, lives could be lost.
Working group co-chair Bev Hoffman told the group that they all have a part in making this summer a success.
We're all in it together, and so it's up to us to calm when we hear the kind of volatile remarks like that. It's up to us to calm people, and I am serious about that.
The group did not want to draw more attention to incendiary ideas, but U.S. Fish and Wildlife Warden Robert Sundown told the assembled fishermen and community leaders how the enforcement works.
The reasons we make our decisions to open or not to open is not going to be because of armed resistance. It's going to be based on the biology of the numbers. And the surest way to get from 12 game wardens that we have on the river to 351 game wardens, the entire fleet in our nation, is to have a gun threat. If you want to see 350 game wardens on this river, that's the surest way to do it.
Okay, you guys.
Tim Andrew from the Association of Village Council Presidents said that empty racks have people worried.
And that rainy season is approaching upon us, and so people are feeling anxiety about being food insecure. You know, salmon is extremely important to the people in the villages. There needs to be some accommodation at some point or some level of assurance from either this body or from the managers that there is going to be something positive on the horizon coming up.
So, how close is the first opening? Federal Manager Brian McCaffrey laid out his plan for the next few days.
We're still, hopefully, looking forward to a first opening, at least downriver, sometime at the end of this week. I've not made a decision on what day that would be. We want to take a look at least one more day's data.
The opening will target chum and red salmon, although some incidental king salmon catch is expected. McCaffrey says the first opening may be below the Johnson River and run a few hours with 6-inch gillnets. The openings would likely move up the river in 3-day intervals. After 2013 showed the weakest run on record and not having made a escapement in 2 of the past 4 years, managers' top priority is getting enough king salmon to spawning grounds. This year's run is early, and past data shows that early runs can end very quickly. After nearly a month of closures, McCaffrey reassured people that salmon fishing is not far off.
I think there is a glimmer there. I certainly know that it's been a difficult season for everyone, but we see openings on the horizon, and so we're hoping that people can be patient.
Working group member Fritz Charles says he'll be passing on the word of potential openings and hopes, too, that people will be patient.
And I'd rather lose king salmon than lose a life.
The working group voted to support managers' decision to study the numbers this week in anticipation of the first opening. The next meeting is at the call of the chair. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Front Street Clinic in Juneau expands its mission.
We wanted people that don't have insurance to have a place to go. I mean, that's the biggest gap in services in any community. People who are working but they don't have insurance.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The state and TransCanada Corporation have formally ended their relationship under terms of the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. Governor Sean Parnell shared the news in an address to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday.
I'm pleased to announce here today that we have terminated the license with TransCanada under AGEA and have now completed a traditional precedent agreement.
TransCanada had state support under AGEA to pursue a gas line to serve North American customers, but the project has shifted focus to overseas markets. State lawmakers approved state participation in the new North Slope to Nikiski gas line this spring, setting the stage for the updated agreement with TransCanada. Governor Parnell says the new arrangement, which also includes North Slope producers, puts the project on a more standard track.
It's a more traditional structure than what we had before. It's a structure that banks and financial institutions are used to providing financing for and that markets are used to seeing.
Parnell says joint venture agreements between the state and the companies are the next step to move the gas line project forward. Governor Parnell signed several bills into law while in Fairbanks, including one authorizing $157.5 million in bonding authority for University of Alaska Fairbanks to finance replacement of its aged-out coal-fired power plant. State funding will fill out the rest of the tab for the $232 million project. Parnell also signed a bill that adds Big Bull Moose derbies to a list of charitable games the state can license. The derby allows hunters to buy tickets and win a cash prize if they kill the biggest moose. It was forwarded by Representative Tammy Wilson of North Pole on behalf of the Tanana Valley Sportsmen's Association and the UAF Rifle Team, which want to use a moose derby to raise money for their program. We've heard a lot about mines planned for northwest British Columbia, just across Alaska's border. Southeast tribal fishing and environmental groups have blasted those plans. Critics say they'll pollute rivers that cross the border, damaging or destroying salmon and other fish runs. But we haven't heard a lot from mine advocates. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld talked to several people in British Columbia's minerals industry and has this story.
Much of the recent focus has been on what's called the KSM project being developed by Seabridge Gold. The site, which also includes copper, is roughly 80 miles east of Wrangell. Critics say it could damage the Unic River, which flows into the ocean northeast of Ketchikan. Seabridge says that's not the case. Brent Murphy is the corporation's vice president for environmental affairs.
With minimizing downstream environmental impacts has been the guiding principle behind the whole design of the mining project.
Critics say the KSM could be about the same size as the proposed Pebble Mine, a controversial project near Bristol Bay. They worry about plans for huge dammed tailing lakes, which could leak or break, sending acidic water into nearby streams and rivers. Murphy says they'll be built in a valley that drains into Canadian, not Alaskan, waters.
The dams will be of a design which have been utilized worldwide, and these dams are extremely stable over the long term.
What is the estimated life of those dams?
Of the dams? I mean, they will go into... They have to last for the 52 years of operations, and then we will reclaim that, and then essentially they will last into perpetuity.
Seabridge Gold has been working on the project for about 6.5 years. Murphy says even if everything goes its way, operations won't begin for another half dozen years.
You don't build a mine overnight.
Karina Brino is president of the Mining Association of British Columbia.
There is a series of authorizations and permits from different levels of government that are required. And other than the Red Chris mine in the northwest, all the other projects are in exploration stages.
The Red Chris mine is in the upper watershed of the Stikine River, which ends near Petersburg and Wrangell. The project is owned by Imperial Metals. Another mine of concern is the long-closed Tulsiqua Chief on a tributary of the Taku River, which ends near Juneau. Chieftain Metals Corporation is trying to get it running again. Critics in all cases are worried about silt, acid discharge, and dangerous metals. The Mining Association's Brino says the same is true for her industry.
Our objective is to minimize impact. Our objective is to be stewards of the environment, as much as, you know, anybody else would want us to be.
Does the industry care about concerns from this side of the border?
Oh, absolutely. My expectation would be that there is participation in hopefully meaningful participation from your side of the border in the review of these projects.
Seabridge Gold official Murphy says his company has consulted with Alaska officials once or twice a year since the project began. They've also been brought to the KSM mine site. He says the project needs about 150 permits from the provincial and federal governments.
We will have to do a lot of work in order to gather the information that will be needed to satisfy the regulatory to satisfy the questions from our regulatory authorities.
Seabridge just began a season of exploratory drilling at the site that will help better define where the minerals are and how much may be there. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Water is being used to flush fuel out of the tundra where a tanker truck rolled off the Dalton Highway earlier this month. The Nana Corporation truck is estimated to have leaked in excess of 2,500 gallons of fuel near milepost 299, about 110 miles south of Dead Horse. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation on-scene coordinator Tom DeRider says the sloped spill area is being flooded with water.
When the fuel left the truck, it went down into the tundra mat and the duff that was below that. The ice layer, the area that's still frozen, is down about 3 to 6 inches below the tundra mat. And so most of the fuel is contained in the upper layers. And what we've been trying to do is to flood the area to move the fuel out of the tundra down to collection areas.
DeRider says the 2.7-acre spill zone is being treated one section at a time.
We put up what's called shore seal boom, and the shore seal boom is a series of tubes that are all connected that are filled with water so that they're heavy and they conform to the ground and they form a barrier. So as the water floods down into them, it builds up behind.
DeRider says the lighter-than-water fuel floats to the surface and is mopped up with absorbent material. Over 300 bags of oiled sorbents had been collected as of Monday. DeRider says tundra samples are tested to determine the remaining level of fuel contamination.
Checking to see if some of the volatiles of the diesel are still coming off of there, trying to get it down to a given level before we stop the flooding and flushing process.
DeRider says about a fifth of the spill area had been treated as of Tuesday and could not estimate how much longer the cleanup would take. He adds bear, fox, squirrels, and birds have been spotted in the area but have been kept out of the spill zone.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Juneau police are reporting the recovery of an 8-foot dance paddle that was stolen Saturday after the end of Celebration, the big biennial cultural event in the capital city. Lieutenant Chris Sell says a homeowner who lives near a Juneau theater reported finding the paddle. It may have been dropped or dumped by thieves on the run. The homeowner called police Monday evening after seeing a picture on Facebook about its theft from the theater parking lot. At least 5 vehicles were rifled and various items stolen during Saturday night's late show. Sell says the red and black paddle is still in one piece and appears to be undamaged. It's safely stored in the police station's evidence room. The paddle was crafted by carver Doug Chilton and Sitka dancer Wilbur Brown and his family, and it was first used at Celebration this year. Brown is a member of the cake dance group Kekwan. Brown was unavailable for comment on Wednesday afternoon. Juno's Front Street Clinic is now providing service to the general public while also continuing care for the homeless. Renamed the Front Street Community Health Center, it's operating under a new business model after Southeast Alaska Regional Health Corporation severed ties at the end of April. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
When Search first announced the closure of Front Street Clinic last fall due to budgetary constraints, Front Street's behavioral health specialist Mary Fitzgerald says the providers were worried.
What are these homeless people going to do? The winter is coming on. They're vulnerable. But then the community came forward and said, no, this just can't happen. What can we do?
Community donations kept the downtown clinic open while a new board of directors formed to take over for Search. Front Street Community Health Center is able to continue serving the homeless with the help of two major grants, but it's still not enough. The difference will be made up by opening the doors to everyone, from the uninsured to the insured, even cruise ship passengers who have an urgent need. Front Street has been known as a homeless clinic for 10 years. Manager Jana Brewster is happy to continue that work, but hopes Front Street can help others as well.
We wanted people that don't have insurance to have a place to go. I mean, that's the biggest gap in services in any community. People who are working, but they don't have insurance.
Brewster says they've had to turn away community members for years.
Every day we get phone calls from people who are not homeless, who can't find a doctor in town or couldn't find medical care. And now we don't have to say no.
Front Street staff includes 3 full-time and 3 part-time employees. Brewster expects the staff will grow to meet demand.
We have a pediatrician that might come join. We hope we can do more with kids and teens and really expand to just help out overall through the community.
Throughout the 7-month transition, there was no interruption in medical service to the homeless. Dean Smith suffered 4 strokes in 2010. He's been going to Front Street for a couple of years for medical and behavioral health services.
I'm not as nervous about my own health as I was prior to seeing them. Being diagnosed with arteriosclerosis in your head, you know, that's kind of an unnerving feeling. Basically, that means you could have 6 seconds, 6 minutes, 6 hours. You know, you never know.
Smith is happy he can still see Fitzgerald and Brewster now that Front Street is no longer in fear of closing. Brewster says many patients were worried, especially when the old Search sign was taken down at the end of April. The new sign wasn't yet ready.
During that time, it was kind of quiet, and the word was going around that we were not going to be here. In fact, someone even heard we weren't even here anymore. But we put the sign back up, and it's like all of a sudden, you know, everyone's kind of calmed down. They know we're here, and they feel very happy that we're still going to be able to help them. That's the most wonderful part of all of this, is that there are people out there that are so grateful for what we do.
The new Front Street Community Health Center sign is in place, inviting new patients. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Last month, the Rasmussen Foundation announced the recipients of this year's Individual Artist Awards. Several Sitka artists were on that list, and 3 of them share the same last name. KCAW's Greta Mart reports.
I am Kagwantan, and I'm from the Eagle Nest House.
That's Tlingit Master Carver Dave Galanin. Over 3 decades of artistic endeavors in Sitka, Dave has received lots of recognition for his work. But this year, something unusual happened. Not only did Dave receive a sizable grant from Alaska's Rasmussen Foundation, his 2 sons, Nicholas and Jared Galanin, also received artist grants from the same private foundation.
This is definitely the first time that we've had individuals from the same family receive awards in the same year.
That's foundation spokesman Jason Smart. Every year, hundreds of Alaskan artists submit grant applications to the private foundation, which directly supports artists working and living in the state. When the 2014 recipients were announced, it took the Galanins by surprise. Here's Dave again.
I didn't know that my boys put in for it, and they didn't know that I did. When I got the call, I was down at the beach here throwing a ball for my dog. I get a phone call, and it's a guy from Rasmussen, and it was kind of hard to contain myself, but I was like pretty excited then.
They told him not to tell anyone until foundation staff made an official announcement.
So, and I didn't say anything, and then I get a call from Jared, and he's like, "Hey, Dad, I got some good news. I got the Rasmussen." I said, "Wow, way to go. I guess I might as well tell you, too." I said, I got the Graspers in Grant, too. It was funny, though. Nick didn't get anything. He didn't get a call, you know. It was just, you know, I guess I didn't get mine.
Nicholas got his call the next day.
So we all went up to Anchorage, and that was really fun. Apparently, we only go on family vacations if we win awards. So.
Dave and Nicholas each received artist fellowships, an award of $18,000 designed to give mid-career and mature artists the time and money to create. Jared won a project award, which comes with a no-strings-attached cash award of up to $7,500 for the creation of a specific artwork. Right now, he's figuring out what exactly that'll be. Unlike his brother, Jared hasn't pursued a career as an artist full-time.
Last year was the first time I had a full-time job in a long time because I always bounce around. I was a land surveyor. Before that, I've worked as a shipwright, I've worked as a carpenter, I've worked as a commercial fisherman.
Yet his jewelry is on display in Anchorage galleries and at the Devilfish, the Sitka gallery owned and operated by the Glannon brothers.
Yeah, and I've always had artwork somewhat in the background and would be happy to make an occasional sale.
But that is changing, says Jared.
I've just really been focusing on the gallery and thinking about art projects and experimenting with that.
With his fellowship grant, Dave said he's going to increase the scale of his work and shoot for a one-man show somewhere in the Pacific Northwest.
I've actually started a full-size, life-size Chilcat robot of copper.
Nicholas is a conceptual artist whose work is shown in galleries and museums around the world. This month, the Glannon brothers attended the opening of Nicholas's current show at Seattle's Fry Art Museum. And after that, Nick will head to Japan for another show opening. His award is already partly spent, he said.
I'll get new equipment, and I'll get some new tools and materials, and I've already started and even have finished some new projects from that anticipation of getting that check.
While they pursue their current projects separately, it's clear the Glannons collaborate well together. Here's Jared.
I work with Nick a lot, and Nick's my neighbor. Late at night, we'll just stay up and brainstorm and talk about art and just do different projects. We hunt sea otter. We both want to do the fish skin. So that really excites me, just being able to work with my brother.
And thanks to these art grants, the Glannons can do that more often. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Greta Mart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld, Lisa Fu, and Matt Miller in Juneau, and Greta Mart in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're having trouble taking medications or forgetting to take pills on time, there's help available for these serious common problems. Talk to your prescriber or pharmacist right away and visit meded.alaska.gov. There you'll find tips on safety, saving money, and more. When you take your medications as directed, you protect your health and independence. You protect your future. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.